now where it is now, everybody wants a piece of the market.
Oh my God, that is funny!
I don't remember asking you a
little volume.
I'm funny how? I mean funny like I'm a clown, I amuse you?
With all due respect, what the f*** are you talking about?
Give me a little volume if you can.
What the f*** is so funny about me? Tell me what's wrong.
You represent the idiocy of today.
I did not know that.
English motherfucker, do you
not to me, it's not.
How's my shit together? Is my shit together?
Nice personality combination. Hostile and intolerant.
There's a little knob.
That's it, then. No one else really knows anything.
Jocks. Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Here, right now. Right here.
We're live.
Well, I don't pick Stocks and Jacks. I'm talking about Jim Lawler on the board doing his thing over there. S&P Futures, we're trying to rally back here from Friday's huge sell-off. S&P Futures up 33, NASDAQ Futures up 161. Does not surprise me that the buy the dippers are all over this because it's quite the dip Friday, just as a way of review, those that are trying to forget. Dow was down 541. NASDAQ was down 472. That's 2.2%. S&P was down 101, it's 1.6. A bad jobs report, and somewhat of an amazing reaction to that, where the president fired the messenger, even though it's been showing up for the last 2 or 3 months, as we report with Carl every month, that the undercurrent of the numbers have not been good. Evidently, you're not supposed to give bad numbers. What are we going to do? We get a bad CPI number. We're going to fire that guy. Anyway, I think we have Greg Pappas on the line, don't we?
Yes. What's going on, guys?
How are you, bud?
Just hanging out.
I'm
across the street. Sorry, I wasn't able to run over.
Well, that's all right. You're hanging upside down like a bat or a regular hanging out?
Hanging out.
There you go.
Regular.
Hey, what is the story? Let's kick this stuff up here whilst I'm talking about you. Copper is 445, down from the 545 after being up from 5 to 545 pretty darn quick.
Isn't it interesting how Goldman recommends to their clients to buy copper, and then the next day Trump says something and immediately it's down 5% or 10%?
I think the amount of insider trading going on between what's going on with these people, it's not unusual that, matter of fact, real quick story. Dr. J, way back in the day when he had a DPM, I forget what the name of the stock was, but the biggest owner of the stock was the guy, what's the guy's name? Simplex or he's the biggest producer of potatoes.
J.R. Simplex.
Yeah, he's from Idaho.
Simplot.
Yeah, and he produces all the French fries from McDonald's, and at least back in those days he did.
Yeah, he's in Idaho, Oregon, and Western Washington.
Yeah, and so Jan had his stack, and somehow or another the guy, he had a margin call about something. And whatever stack this was, it wasn't his stack, it was like Micron or something like that. And it wasn't Micron, but it was a stack that Jan had in his DPM. And he ended up going down, 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 and Goldman says, you got to sell the rest of it. So, and they gave him a price, and they bought it at like $7.50 or something.
Perfect.
And the minute they did, they put out a recommendation for it, and it was like 9 2 days later or something.
Ah.
So,
yeah. I wasn't surprised. They I think, ran it up to, what, 580,
yeah.
590. And then Goldman was out there saying, hey, you know, we think you should buy call options and stuff. And I'm like, uh-oh. And sure enough, and who knows, you know, the tariff whatever came out the next few days, and it looks like just a bloodbath.
Well,
everybody, yeah.
Well, you know, without mentioning any names, although you know who I'm talking about, we have a friend who is kind of a risk manager. He is a risk manager from one of the big firms that do a lot of trading, and they trade copper. And you can have, I'll try and make this as simple as I can, Greg, but and Jimmy, that there really are only two kinds of option positions. You can do all you want. I've heard people give me some long-ass story about this is the perfect position, the perfect scam that will never... Simple fact is there's two types of positions when you're using options. One, movement helps and staying steady does not because you have time decay. And you have those that if it stays steady, time decay helps, and if it moves, you're in trouble. If it moves a lot or whatever, I'm not saying they're all the same, but basically, am I right with that, Greg? You can say, you have all the theory you want, but there's only two kinds of positions. Well, these guys had some traders trading copper, and they've been trading it for years, and they generally make a few bucks. It's not anywhere near one of their highest price thing, and the guys were long a lot of premium. People were selling them all these puts, evidently. So the risk management people in the firm were giving them no end of grief about how they were long too much, use the term vega. That means their time decay was too high. And they got all these fancy Greek terms, but what that means is every day, if nothing happens, you lose money, right, Greg?
And well, that's theta, yeah.
Well, yeah, but then they also had a lot of, you're right, the theta's time decay. But anyway, the movement, they had, if it moved, they got delta short or long pretty quick. Well, they had this movement. In one day, these dudes made 10 times more than their best year ever.
How about that?
Yeah, and they were getting basically dumped upon because of their position. And all of a sudden, they had all these extra puts that all of a sudden became gold. That normally, I mean, how many people want to...
Yeah, what they were saying, I think, before was, okay, so Trump's going to say, all right, we're going to tariff copper. They take it from, call it 5 to 550 or 580.
Well, that was 25%, right, tariff?
Yeah, that was a day or a couple days, and then he says no tariff, and now it's back down to
he raised it to 50%. He raised it, which is the weirdest thing. Then it came crashing down.
Right on
last week,
July. I forgot what it was. Yeah, it was 3 months ago.
Well, the 3 months ago was the 25%. Then he said something about he was going to double it, and for some reason it crashed instead of went the other way.
Right.
How weird is that? I mean, just crazy stuff. What does that mean? In the day that happened, 85,000 contracts traded. And what's the number, Greg?
When you have a whole bunch of open, and call them teenies, those things get valuable really quick. And just the volatility in the markets, you know, make those pay pretty much
what's the normal volatility, implied vol in copper? Got to be real low.
I'll look it up right now. I mean, you can see it doesn't really mean much because now they've pumped it up. That's HG, right?
Yeah. Because where I'm going with this, and I know it's early on Monday morning to go real technical here, but once in a while we have to, especially with Greg with us because he's our technical guy. If you have a stock, for instance, that is all over the place, it's very volatile, not only is your implied volatility higher than a regular stock or the market, what happens is, say you have a stock that's 100, and your delta of a $100 option is going to be 50, 51, depending on the interest rate, right, Greg?
Right. 52. I'm seeing it as, what, 25 or so?
Well, now, right, what now is it normally? 10?
You know, I mean, 6, call it 1.5 times the equity markets.
Yeah, well, so what I'm saying is that this is part of the theory, so I won't go down this road too far. But if your stock has an implied volatility of, say, 70 or something, which would be a real very volatile stock, the rate and change of your delta, if the stock goes from 100 to 104, the delta probably goes from, what, 51 to 58 or something, 60 maybe? Because they're tied together mathematically. But if you're in a stock or a currency or something or something like copper that virtually never moves, that delta is going to go from probably 51 to 90, right?
Yep. And so, then they're going to take the volatility all the way back down after they're finished.
Well, right. But the point is, your option, your say it was at $5, then went to $4.50. Your puts are now going to be 100 delta puts. They're not going to be 60 or 70 delta puts. I mean, you're out the whole 50 cents. You're not out 20 or 30. So that, you know, that, if you're short that put, I mean, not the whole 50 cents, but you're probably out what, 42 or something. Yeah, I mean, it's like a currency. I mean, a currency like never moves. If you get a two dollar move, and like if the euro goes from you know, like 117 to 114, that's like a stock going from 80 to what, 110 or something.
Yeah. So normally we set the currencies right around like 6 or 7 implied volatility, maybe, and then stocks are definitely, you know, the more volatile ones. They get to 30 to 50. And that just tells you how much more nervous people get about the, call it the high flyers and the QQQ and all the ones that are really, you know, moving more so than the currencies are slow and steady. And then those things move, call it double their normal movement. And then stocks get even more.
Well, what does it mean? What does it mean for somebody who's trading something like this, that you're pretty comfortable if copper is, let's say, 440, you're pretty comfortable being short the five calls or the $4 puts, right? Or at least you used to be. Now you're not. What does that do to the market?
Yeah, that makes it infinitely more scared at the wings, which means you're trading something that's got more premium in far away than it does in the middle.
Right.
So you're skew. So really, if you're, call it a bull, you're going to be buying the at the monies and closer to at the monies rather than farther out, even though you think it's going up, because it's too expensive to buy farther out, because whatever situation has rendered those options, just there's a lot of more premium. So when there's the uncertainty, people ask more if they think of it kind of like insurance.
Well,
they're not going to sell it for.
Who would have ever thought, Greg, if I were to 8 years ago, if I would have said, Greg, you're a pretty good futures trader, you know this stuff, take a look at copper, take a look at silver, take a look at oil, name me the top five, whatever you want to call it. We used to call it a 3S times V move, standard deviation move, or the black swan event, or whatever you want to call it. If you were to list five reasons that could cause that, I will bet you drinks for a year that you would not have a renegade mouthy president as one of the five. You would have had
you'd had a war, you'd had an
asteroid hit in New York, you'd have had something, but you wouldn't have had a president just mouthing stuff off as part of the five, would you?
Not that one. And when he starts talking about different things like tariffs and or war, we get moves in the oil, we get moves in commodities. And for example, when war broke out between Ukraine and Russia, you know, the wheat and the beans and everything went, and especially that night, it was limit moves, and we had no idea. And a year later, you know, we were talking about, oh, wait, now we got too much. And we had made up for more than what we lost in those Ukrainian acres. So we have no idea. And you can see that in volatility. And the sheer size of the moves just makes it obvious who are the responsible kind of players and who are not. Because if you're, call it 1 in 100, if there's 1 in 100, there's 250 trading days. I mean, 1 in 100, it's going to happen twice per year, so you better be careful.
And it means that, and that somebody who's looking to insure his copper or the stuff that we do with the protected index program, for you to buy, you know, puts on something, you're essentially buying insurance. Somebody has to sell it to you.
Right.
And if the person who's selling it to you goes, I already sold some money to the next guy that the price for you is going real high, or I just can't sell it at all. Hey, you mentioned the oil this weekend. OPEC, which I think is pretty much denuded, but decided they're going to up their daily production by what, 400,000 barrels now or something?
And yeah, another 400,000, and we're down a little bit this morning, and still going down. I mean, you can see oil, and you can get SEP oil contract for 66 a barrel now. The thing's moving 2% a day.
Yeah, well, it's down to 66, which it was for a while. Then it spiked up to what they had the one morning print at 77, right? And it's come straight back down again. What do they hope to accomplish? Can you believe them? As Milton Friedman used to say, when you have a cartel, the hardest thing in the world is maintaining discipline in a cartel. How can you tell whether, you know, Iran isn't sneaking some out? If somebody isn't cheating there when they say, you know, I guess you're going to not cheat and put out less oil. But how do they know where the rogue players? There's like, last time I checked, Greg, there's like, just a while ago, there's 21 countries that export oil, right? I mean, some only a little bit, but...
Yeah, there's a lot of them, and there's a lot of incentives to export more than you're allotted. But I think most of it falls back to supply and demand. And what those guys really have to do, and what everybody who exports right now really wants to do, is do as much as they can, because, or as, at least as much as the market's going to take. Whether it's Saudi Arabia or anyone really, they're wanting to sell into this demand. So there's fairly robust demand, and they predict more throughout the summer.
Where's it coming from if things are sort of slowing down, which I think they are, even though the president doesn't like the messenger? While you're here, comment on what's going on with the heating oil versus the other. First of all, explain how this all works. Explain what a barrel oil comes down to.
Yeah, when you crack oil or when you process oil, you get both gas, or at least here you get gas and heating oil,
and other stuff and some other little dribbles.
Yeah,
jet fuel and grease and whatever.
So the processors will be buying their input and then selling the gas and the heating oil to us and whoever else needs it. But where I was going before with the OPEC is, right now, if you're stuck and say you have to have a certain amount of output to fund your main operations, a war, you know, in the terms of Russia, or Saudi Arabia needs to fund its entire social programs and all that with oil.
Not to mention the trips to Epstein's Island.
And the trips to Epstein Island, yeah. Right? So you got a lot, and then there's fairly robust demand from the West, whether it be, whatever, in terms of, call it just energy in general, right? We're not there yet.
Where's that coming from, Greg? Isn't China supposedly down on their imports and stuff? And I mean, there's some places that were just. India's a big hog, right?
Yeah, India. The big thing now is they're trying to bully India into buying more American oil because the Russian oil is, you know, going to be sanctioned, or just geopolitical kind of pressures from a lot of sides. But they're really incented to produce a lot more than whatever the cartel says. So what happens when you get these strong demand reports is they'll go right into them. And as you've seen the past, I think, three or four meetings, they've been ahead of the curve in forecasting. You know, we see a lot of demand and we're going to hit it. And so they're letting people hit it, and because not only it's in their interest, but they have to. So it's not really surprising, but when we see those types of, call them good reports, economic reports, or at least stable, they really like doing it.
Well, when those guys, I'm not expecting you to be hanging around with in Vienna with the shrimp and the booze and the hookers, but when they say we're gonna up it, who decides who does what, and who disciplines? I mean, what if you tell Qatar to come up with 10,000 barrels a day and they come up with 12? Who the hell knows? Or what can you do to them?
Well, supposedly there's checks and balances put in place, but normally what happens is you don't find out about it for a month or 2 months, and you can just get away with, you know, a little slippage, as we call it. So
Can you
if it gets out of hand, then well, I'm sure it's brought up at the next meeting. But there's got to be an understanding of something. You know, hey, we don't talk about this. And
well, oil is like oil is almost like DNA or marijuana. I mean, there are people that could dump a, you know, dip a cup into some oil in a tanker. Not that you can do that. You probably could if you knew where the hole is, and tell you right exactly where it came from. Right? I mean, how much discipline worldwide? I mean, if a tanker full of oil that originated in Russia shows up in a Gulf Coast or New Orleans or someplace, does anybody give a crap? Is anybody making sure it didn't come from a bad place?
Well, I would imagine that people like Trump and people like Putin get real
maybe
sensitive
two other
about
people,
it.
Maybe two other people like Trump and Putin. You say people like them. How many do you think there are? Let's hope there's not too many.
Well, you got Saudi too.
Yeah.
They probably can tell exactly what's what and who's doing what. In terms of like the African countries, I doubt that they have that much pull or really care that much. But you know, the Russia, I mean, Mexico, you can see, but what they do is kind of decide who's willing to unilaterally cut. So like in 20 and 2023, you know, sometimes they'll say, Saudi, we're cutting, that's it. And they forecast it to the press, but if they stop, you know, that's a big loss. So
is Mexico still a player? Because Pemex was huge when I was still trying to trading floor. I mean, it was that big conglomerate that was Pemex was the state oil company of Mexico, right? Are they still? They were a big chunk of our imports, and they exported huge. They kept up, or we pretty much run right by them, haven't we? With the
so Permian they're not Basin. A full member. And then I don't think they've ever been an official member, but they are part of the plus.
Okay, so OPEC plus.
Right,
but I mean their production hasn't continually gone up like ours. I don't think.
No. They're definitely not a full member. I know that there's what 12 full members, and then Venezuela's still.
Well, Russia's a plus, right?
Yeah.
Well, what do you think if you had to put your finger on it? I'm going to say,
I don't know. There's some really obscure. OPEC members.
Oh,
I think
there's Libya. There's all kinds of people. That Morocco. They all
there's
export
like
oil.
Guinea and Congo and still Venezuela. Like there's and then
what is their status? Is anybody getting anything from there?
I mean, they're supposed to.
What I know you got to go to work here pretty soon, but when this is also we try on the show to be informative. We also know this is such a complicated subject. If you're a refinery set up for stuff from Venezuela, all of a sudden they punk out on you, you can't just turn around and decide, okay, you're going to take Russian oil, right? It could be a totally different grade and you're not set up for it. I mean, you can't just go back and forth and whatever shows up, you plunk in your place, right?
Right. The ones that we watch the most would... I think you really need to watch for Saudi Arabia, Iraq, and Iran. I mean, those guys do, I think, the majority of it, with Saudi being the most.
Well, this is OPEC.
Right.
Well, where's Iran? They're not part of that. Obviously, they're not in there, are they?
Well, they produce, I think.
But, I mean, they're not part
they
of the meeting.
They produce maybe a third of what Saudi Arabia produces, probably just under Iraq.
All right, but they're not part of the meeting. They don't go to the meeting. Do the Iraq people go to the meeting?
I think what happens is they have their more like a voting system, and they probably they give their input.
Ah,
you know?
Yeah, because it would be well, Saudi's a big one, but there's a bunch of them around there. Which is the only one in the Mid East that doesn't have oil? Is that Qatar? One of those guys doesn't.
They're supposed to. I mean, basically, they just follow Saudi Arabia.
All right.
And well, then if you dissent, there's some, like, press conference, and that's about it.
What would you guess?
It's supposed to be one country, one vote. but you know, I don't. That what they need is usually unanimous.
Well, as the Permian, the fracking has gotten so much more efficient. What would you? Now, when I say this, I know it's a dumb question because every single oil well, every single area has its own break even, right? And where you're going to stop production if it's 50, if it's 40, if it's 30, right? But in general, the Permian has advanced in the fracking to the point where their break even has dropped fairly precipitously, right? In terms of its, well, it used to be like 65, now it's probably like 30 or something, isn't it?
It depends on how many. Well, yeah, you're right. So as fracking became more and more common and easy and quick, it really pays for them every time the price, say, jumps. They can easily turn on the fracking and grab whatever they want to sell and satisfy the demand.
Because this is how can I say this without acting like a knucklehead? We used to go to these. Did you ever go to those money show things?
Well, I mean, we're not part of that group that decides. But no, if we see some, yeah.
I was kind of wandering down a different road here for a second. I used to go to these money shows and do a lot of option training, right? Like with the CBOE mostly, and sometimes PTI would go ourselves. But there's all kinds of oil and gas people in the place, and every spot has, you know, whether it's a oil well and Alaska with no road or pipeline near it, whether it's someplace somewhere, every it's all very unique to the particular well, to the particular area. Correct. I mean, you could put an investment into a gas company, say natural gas, and it's in a county where all you have to do is drill, and you know exactly what you're going to get. I mean, it's not going to be some big dinger, but it's enough gas for you to make some money, and some of them return 8-10% pretty much. Others are, we're looking for the gusher where it's an 80% chance of getting nothing back. There's a 20% chance of getting, $10 per dollar back. So they're all over the place. And if you look at what was going on when the fracking first started, remember, Greg, we were going to do all that fracking in Illinois. Because remember the big bitch fights down in the state where who's going to pay for the bridges, for all the big equipment that had to go over them. And then all of a sudden, there was a map. They were going to do all this stuff in northeastern Ohio and southeastern Ohio. And when oil got to be like $90 or $100, then all of a sudden, as soon as it went down, all these areas pretty much stood down. I don't think there's any fracking in Illinois or northeast Ohio, but because it's $67, plus the fields out west got a lot more efficient to where we don't need those places. I mean, they're still there. There's still oil there and natural gas. But now we're doing, almost 13 million barrels a day in the U.S., up from like 5. You know what's weird? Why do you think politically, Jimmy?
It's easy that we can do that now because, and especially it's good because, call it, we're sanctioning the other places like Iran, Russia, and Venezuela. And when you can satisfy that demand and just plug in kind of fairly easily, I mean, that's a win-win. In terms of shale, I think break-even for us is probably like 45, maybe on the higher end is 55. So if they wanted to, they could still make money. If you go into like the best fields in North Dakota, you can get 38.
Really? It's that low? And I'm trying to find here the
I would say a new one right now, if you're start a new well or you're drilling one that's in a pretty good spot, it's probably $50.
Really?
But in the best and most productive spots, you can get down to 40, definitely.
Well, how much of that is the fact that you have a pipeline? So, do they ever finish the pipeline to the Permian? Because for a while it was all rail, and that's obviously a pipeline's a hell of a lot cheaper.
I'm thinking the power, the water, and the transportation probably are the main costs. So they don't look to do it until 55 or 65, but yeah. It's
well, the because we've gone up, what's weird, this you read all about not so much Epstein and everything, but how far all this stuff goes back and the connections between the Saudis and all this other kind of crap. The only president in certainly in our lifetime that had a decreasing oil production during his terms was George Bush the second. Those guys were so in tight with the Saudi. You think there was any screwing around there or what? I mean, it just begs the question. I mean, now we're 13-3.
I don't think it was a priority really because they saw the opportunity in the Middle East.
Well, yeah,
but they weren't working as much on the technology then. So,
well, we're slightly down from where's our tippy top here? It looks like it was in March of 2025, somewhere in there. And it's actually we've been hanging in the mid 13 million barrels a day now for quite a while. You can go to the petroleum, whatever this thing is. Every week they'll tell you what the number is. From going back to God knows what thing here, but it's all during the first Trump administration, which would have been 2017. We started out at 9.7 million a day. We got to go back to January. We started out at 8.9 million per day. And when Trump left office, now again, this COVID cut this all the way down, so you can't blame this on Trump. So when you get to January 21, we're at, he was on a big move up, okay, but then it went down while he was in there because of the COVID. I won't blame this on Trump. I got plenty of other stuff to blame on Trump, but so January of 21, we were at 11 million, but he had made it up to, that's about the top. He had made it up there.
Last time I looked, EIA said that it was about 13.4, 13.5, and that the majority of it was coming from Texas and New Mexico.
Well, under the Biden administration, again, now because of COVID was over, so if you go from, he was up to 13.5, so he had a dramatic increase in his presidency. Even though, if you listen to the drivel out of the White House, all he did was bury the industry. Well, they're up 2.5 million barrels a day. He didn't exactly bury the industry. Now, whether he liked the industry or didn't or not, and
if you go by profits, the profits are probably much lower right now because of the crack. You can tell kind of how much money they're going to be making via the crack spread, and it's lower. I mean, the profits for those companies, they're lower, and that's just a function of, you know, global supply and the problems in the Middle East, and it's more supply and demand related. Well, rather,
if we pop from 69, say all of a sudden there's a big turnoff in the Middle East. If we pop from 69 to 85, clearly in every well that you're drilling right now, you got $16 more profit on top of it, right? But your extra oil you now need to fill in the gap from wherever it's not coming from, that you're probably gonna have to pay more to get out of the ground, right? So it's not on the increased production, you're probably not making as much, but on the stuff that you're dragging out of the ground every day at $30, I mean, if oil goes from 69 to 90, you're having a good day, right?
Oh yeah, I mean, and one thing that we're lucky to have here is easy access. The world prices would go much faster than the American prices, and I don't know if you take comfort in, but one thing that would be good is those prices would incent a whole lot of oil coming out of the ground.
Well, there's a lot of capped wells, right? I mean,
right.
You drive along I-80, you see going through Nebraska. What do they call those? I actually saw a big special on those things on YouTube and how they're designed. The big stupid wells. It looks like it's a bird going in the ground and coming back up. Those big counterweighted things. And there's a big huge barrel next to the thing, right? That the guy comes out once a week and empties the barrel out of probably, you know, 500 gallons or something.
If I was with one of the oil majors or someone, and all of a sudden something goes bananas and oil goes to 100, you immediately start redeploying the rigs and getting your rigs activated, and then your uncompleted. You just go for everything that's permitted, and that usually takes anywhere from 1 to 3 months. And then
you're talking about stuff that's already sort of there, not you're not talking about a new well you can't do in 1 month.
Right, right. So you go for everything that's already there, and you start up with the Permian, and I'd say in the futures you go out 2 to 3 months, and you just start selling as many futures as you can.
Because you know,
because you know you have it.
So you want to be long the near term and short the out term.
Yeah, and you'll see that in the skew and the options too. And I'm sure if people want to do stuff like that, you can show them how. But what you really need to, for the first month, you know, anything goes. So the contract's going to go nuts. The second and the third months, there's going to be heavy, heavy selling. Yeah. And that's only here though, because it's easy. But in the rest of the world, you know, they might go for it too. So you could see.
We have to get you get you to work in Jan-Am, but do you ever get any do stuff in any of these other, I won't call them wacky exchanges, story is one of these, somebody from listens to the show called me up one day and said that they had a whole bunch of, when they were making bunker oil, the heavy stuff, you can't use it on ships anymore. Well, this dude, of course, had a whole bunch of bunker oil, which is a heavy grade, and wanted to know if he could hedge it, and how he could ship it from the Gulf Coast where nobody wanted anymore to some place that didn't care. It must be like China or Peru or somebody or other. Not saying bad about Peru. And there's all kinds of oil futures contracts traded all around the world, all different. They actually trade bunker crude in like Rotterdam or someplace. Did you know that?
I haven't done it, but I'm sure you can. Are you talking about the high sulfur?
The real heavy crap, the bunker stuff. It's like grade. Well, diesel's number two, there's number three, there's number four. They used to use five in some of the schools, but I'm thinking bunker is like three or four or something. You know, it's just heavy oil. That's why it belches out all that smoke.
Yeah, and probably it's blended.
Yeah, into something. Well, anyway, hey, thanks, bud. See you this week a few times.
Good to be back. Yeah. Happy always to talk. We need to talk grains, too, at some point.
Yeah, well, maybe we'll do it next Monday. We should have Mr. Flanagan. John, you with us?
Morning, yes. Tom. Morning, Greg.
How are you?
Good. How about you?
I mean, Audrey's got to be taking somebody to the doctor early this morning, so we're short of late guests. So hopefully, you can hang. So you're not getting cheated on time. We just shifted you a little bit.
Oh, that's fine. No problem.
What? So are you? Did you send your little resume in for the job of Bureau of Labor Statistics?
Be careful what you wish for, Tom. I've been saying that on this show for how many years?
What if we get with a bad CPI number this month? That guy going too?
Well, we shall see. There has been so much funny business about revisions. The revisions alone make you think that there's something, you know, deliberately misleading going on all the time. So it's a sad thing that the statistics have become so unreliable. At least,
what makes you think they're unreliable? They are
revisions. You know, will eat up the last gains for the previous 6 months. So what? It's all about juicing something in the moment, and as soon as that moment passes, there's another reason not to do it. So I find it, these swings, just ridiculous.
Well,
that's the way they gather statistics, and clearly there's something wrong.
Well, but that when Dan, my brother Dan, was president of the PTI, used to work for GATX, and GATX used way back in the day, and GATX had and then you would actually get the survey. They'd send it to you if you're over. I think he said the break even at the time. Break even. The amount of employees was like 4,500 people, and GATX was over that. So they had to send in the report, and it's the third one of the month, and some people's get there on time, and some people's don't. I mean, and that's why you have, these revisions. And they're not surprising to me in the sense that Carl's been talking for months, that if you dig into the reports of the last few months, they're nowhere near as strong as the headline number would lead you to believe. And sure enough, they come out with a couple of revisions. The people that were late or something, or somebody said we were mistaken or whatever. I mean, I don't know how all this stuff is very sort of sloppy, but it's also sloppy in a way where, how many months did Carl and I spend 10 minutes on a Friday talking about the household survey doesn't match the establishment survey. And the single biggest technical reason for that is in the establishment survey, if somebody has two jobs, they're counted as two jobs. The household survey, it's one guy working. And it doesn't matter if he has 10 jobs or one, he's counted as one person working. Well, there is a serious, in a time where Nancy tells us all the time, where people to get their mortgages or to put a kid in the traveling team, there's all kinds of people that have a second job. And I've heard lately that some people are having trouble with the second jobs because they're not around. So there's all kinds of moving parts to this, Jen, we're talking about. So I don't know that, I mean, but the idea that something is untoward, I just think the way, but I, well, how else, how can you figure out how many people in a country like this every month? You have to pick a week. I mean, it's a very, very difficult job. And is I don't know that there's, I mean, you think the lady started up in the morning to screw Trump? The economy is slowing right now, and he refused to believe it. I had dinner with my brothers yesterday, and my nephew's in the, everybody knows, I think, because I talk about it. He's in the metal stamping, metal serve. What do you call it, John, where you do, you'll, if something breaks in a machine, you'll do it. There's other stuff where you just do it because they know.
Oh, millwright or?
They do, you know, emergency fix-it parts to work on a Saturday if somebody's machine conks out and you got to make a machine apart from scratch. They can do that. They get blacksmiths there and that kind of thing. But they also have people that, okay, we need 10 of these a week for the whole year. You know, the, kind of the regular production stuff plus the, you fix it. And he says, in the last month, last 6 to 8 weeks, everything has ground to a halt. They haven't worked a Saturday. He called two or three people that he used to work for. They're almost laying people off. All of a sudden, something, and I'm not blaming it on this or that, the other. The fact is, there's been a slowdown in a lot of areas in the last 6 to 8 weeks. Now you can be in denial. You can.
I'm not saying that there aren't you know job losses, because I don't think the jobs numbers have ever, you know, been dependable. And for one thing, they're internally inconsistent, Tom. You and I have talked many times about how you can't understand a revision up or down given the numbers on the table. There's something else being weighted or, you know, pushed into the number that nobody can decode.
Well, there's a deadline, Jen, and the number you publish. So what if you get stuff after the deadline? It's a revision.
Well,
right.
There's too much writing on these numbers to be that slippery. There's got to be a better way of doing it, either in the tag, you know, the timetable for how these numbers are produced, and a kind of, you know, expectation. We expect a revision today, up or down. This, you know, a rough number. This is what companies do when they have trial balances for bookkeeper. I mean, they're pretty sure where they are, but they're not exactly sure. But it's pretty clear to me that the BLS has no idea where the numbers are at all.
I mean, well, so, I think they do. I actually think there's a big difference between.
Well, maybe they do, Tom, but they're not letting you know what it is.
What there's a big difference between, in my opinion. I know you're politically, people have to somehow try and defend this. They've been doing it this way for a long time. Now, I think we both would agree, if we ever do, that if we were to make it, you know, if we all landed in the Oval Office, if we're going to make this, you know, public enemy number one to really know, you know, whether or not it's a second job, third job, it would be some massive investment. Somebody would almost have to report online every day who's there for work that day. We could do this, okay, if we wanted to. And we could somehow match up the household survey with the other and all these other kinds of things if we wanted to spend a gazillion dollars and do it. Now, that's not the same as I don't like the numbers, you're fired. It's nowhere near the same. Because I don't think this lady's doing any different than she did it 5 years ago. Now, is there a better way? Yeah. I'm sure there's always a better way. There's a better way to take in a dump, for God's sake. I mean, if you think about it. But I mean, it isn't the same as saying, I don't like the numbers, they're crooked, you're doing this to make me look bad, you're fired. That is abominable to me.
But the numbers have always been so politically useful.
Oh, well, I mean,
it's really hard to say for sure how much, you know, integrity there is in any given period politically, depending on which way the wind seems to be blowing.
Why do you accuse somebody of doing it. How do you know that? How do you
I'm
know?
Not, I'm not accusing anybody. I'm just saying I have no reason to believe that they were done correctly, given their past record. So, you know,
what do you mean past record? You don't think that over a yearly deal or a 2 year that they're as good as they can be? I mean, how good can they be?
Well, I think they should be better than they are. Tom. I think you do too. You know?
Well, I mean, there are points of contention. One of the biggest issues, and I've said this, you know, many times, doesn't make it right, that one of the biggest problems is if people are not employees, and we're reaching a period now where there's an awful lot of contract people, which I think is very difficult for the Bureau of Labor Statistics to figure out. Okay, now why is that? Well, so say for instance, Jim and John and I decide we're going to be in the house business, and we're going to go build 15 houses. And then all of a sudden, it's a really good year, and we start hiring people. And we're not paying them cash under the table or anything like that. We're giving them a check, but they're contract people. They're carpenters or this, that, and the other thing. And nobody's going to know where they're working until the end of the year, right? Unless they call us up, which they're not going to do, because we got 100 employees and not 4,500. So there's this judgment that somebody makes out of Washington, and I don't necessarily think that if he's a Republican, he's gonna piss on the Democrat presidency or the other way around. I mean, some people you have to believe. Somebody has to make a determination a couple of times a year as to whether or not, they call it the birth and death estimate. If the economy is going good, I always think that the way the statistics are gathered, that the numbers are going to show. It's actually growing faster than the numbers are going to show. Now, but then the next year, all of a sudden, the economy goes to scat-ta. You and I lay all these people off, say, this is a really bad idea. Nobody's going to know that for a year either. So there's this constant, who are you picking up and who you aren't? And you look at this entire area of high-tech stuff. The people you hire to put a new system in or something. I know all kinds of people that are contract people. They haven't been an employee forever. I'm going to go here. It's a 2-year job. I get paid as a 1099 employee. I think it's very, very difficult to track those people. Being it difficult, and do we really know if Chan Flanagan gets hired as a contract attorney for some big case, and you're working 30 hours a week, and they're paying you $300 an hour to go in and do research, and they give you a check once a month? We're not going to know that, are we? Until the end of the year. You always, the 1099 goes in, and all of a sudden you got to pay, you send in a tax return. So there's a lot of slippage, but as long as the slippage is kind of known and stay, I don't know how, what else are we going to do, John? Now, if somebody calls your house, if you had a wife, and she answers the phone, yeah, John's working. Okay, now you're going to be in a household survey. This is way more complicated than one guy shooting off his mouth, and whether you like him, you agree with him, and whether you don't. I mean, it's way more complicated.
It has become so complicated that I don't think it's useful. I think it's no less immune, no more immune to, you know, politicizing the numbers than the census is.
But who's the politicizer? they politicized the consumer, the CPI, in my opinion, for 25 years. Now, that seems to never get changed. Everybody has the medical stuff at 6.5% of the basket. Everybody knows that's wrong. Now, is that influence from the drug companies? It's not like, yeah, well, you're not going to see.
I can't say for sure where the influence comes from. The point is that it renders the numbers pretty useless, I think.
Well, do you think that? Well, they are sort of what they are. I mean, you have to know where to look.
I can't rule out the possibility, whether it's the pharmaceutical industry or the AMA or somebody else who doesn't want people to see this. I mean, that's the way I would think.
Do you think Trump wants people to come clean on anything other than the stuff? You think he wants a full CPI report this time, where we jump the medical stuff from 6 to 20? What do you think that report looks like on his watch? He doesn't want to fix it if it goes the other way.
Well, we will see. You know, when you fire somebody, and you know, the idea is to clean house
is to put his schmuck in there so the next numbers are good.
I wouldn't go that far.
Okay, I hope that's not what happens either. But it's the idea was not that I'd like these numbers to be better with less revisions. I want the numbers done properly. I'm willing to invest. I'm not going to lay people off there. I'm willing to invest money because I think the numbers are more important than other people seem to be. I'm with him 100%. That's not what he said. The numbers are screwed. She's screwing me. She's out. Okay, well, that's a problem.
He's entitled to his opinion, Tom.
That's right. What do you say we go to a real quick break because
let's not forget that he's got lots of reasons to say he's been screwed by you.
He gets to
pick a list.
He gets to do what?
It wouldn't surprise me he would feel that way. That's all I'm saying.
It wouldn't surprise me he'd feel a lot of different ways, but that's a problem. S&P futures up 33, NASDAQ futures at 166. We're just gonna have a real quick advertisement come back because we'll do our traffic, weather, sports at the bottom of the hour.
Hello, this is Tom Howell, the Chief. I think most of you know that I'm also the Chief Investment Officer of PTI Securities and Futures. There we invest for and help a wide variety of clients, and you know what? No two are the same. Some have legacy stocks, some concentration issues, some maybe embedded tax issues. The others might need or want some portfolio protection. There could be estate issues or maybe new family members. The point is that we are all unique and the portfolios should match. However, the last several years I've seen a relatively one-way market. It seemed that all we needed was to be all in. No protection, no fixed income, just be all in, no matter who you are or what your risk profile or age. Most management firms love that. Take this and like it, no matter who you are. Be careful with that. You are not everybody. I think most see the market view going forward as maybe different than the one looking back, so your portfolio should reflect that. Maybe it's just as simple as your life station has changed. Towards that end, we are accepting some new clients needing a more personal approach and are interested in negotiating the future and not with a portfolio designed for the past. Find me at 312-663-4310. That's 312-663-4310.
Hi, I'm Audrey Johnson, an owner of Home Source Realty and a frequent contributor to Stocks and Jocks. If you're nervous about the stock market and considering diversification, or are looking for a rate of return way better than your banks, consider adding rental properties to your portfolio. Whether it's a condo, single family, or multi-unit building, I can help you select a property that meets your financial needs. Call or text me at 708-349-3456. That's 708-349-3456. Or visit my website at myhomesourcerealty.com. That's myhomesourcerealty.com.
Stocks and jocks. Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right now. You're back.
Jenny, if you look at, again, we bounce on, before, let's talk about something later for a second because I'm looking at these labor numbers. If you look at did you watch the fiasco in Tennessee? We got to give Carlson crap when he gets on the air. The baseball thing Saturday night?
I read about it later. Didn't see it, but
I'm watching this thing, Aud and I were out to dinner, and this is on. I could not figure out what in the hell they were doing because they had Poppy and A-Rod and who the other guy is, and they're showing this baseball diamond, and it's pouring rain, and they're showing a speedway, and I'm thinking, are they guys, because the game is getting rained on, they're going to go to show the speedway? But the speedway, I never put two and two together that it was the same place. Well, it turns out there's never been a Major League Baseball game in the state of Tennessee. So they decided, and they also have never had a crowd of 90,000 people for a baseball game, which kind of surprises me, Jan, because when the Dodgers first went to L.A., they played in the Coliseum. I thought they had... Jimmy, didn't they have some like 70 and 75,000 crowds back then in the 50s when they first went out there?
I would bet they did.
So they decide to have put this baseball field in the middle of the infield of this huge racetrack, you know, sort of like Indy. And they got all these people up in the stands, and it's quite the scene, and they're going to have this game. Didn't they sell like 90,000 tickets or something? Well, it's pouring a blue streak. I mean, it's coming down like you're in your shower, for God's sake. They got a tarp. Tarp's on the field, and I don't know what time it's supposed to start, but this is pushing 8:30 or 9. It's I'm not positive. So they decide somehow or another it stops, Jennifer. Like, so you would think in this day and age, you'd be all over the radar, and you know you have some weather person telling you, okay, it's going to stop. It's going to this. They decide they're going to start the game, and the minute they do, it starts pouring. Again, I'm thinking, well, they must be telling them, just get through 2 or 3 or 5 minutes, it's going to pass. It doesn't pass. It just keeps raining. The infield is now, and they're playing. The guys are hitting the ball. And the infield in some spots is 2 inches deep. And I've never seen this happen in the middle of the inning, not to wait till the end of the inning. They send a bunch of schmoes out with the 50-pound thing on their shoulder, the dry stuff, and they start spreading it around in the puddles. I'm going, meanwhile, it wasn't like it had stopped then and they were trying to fix the field up. It's still pouring. Plus, this thing doesn't have the drainage in the middle of the infield like a Major League Baseball stadium would have. Finally, they decided to call it and have it yesterday. But the upshot of it was, evidently not being from Tennessee, and again, we got to give Carl Nolan a crap about this. Evidently, if you're a Tennesseer and you go to these stock car races, you get to bring a soft-sided cooler with, I don't know if you can bring bottles, but you certainly can bring cans. You bring your beer and pop and everything in the cooler and a sandwich or whatever else you're doing. So they don't have anywhere near the concessions for a 90,000-person stadium that you would if you had a football stadium that hold 80,000 people. I mean, you've got all that stuff, right? You got all these people, beer vendors and everything else. Well, they don't have any of that stuff. So all these people are there. There's no concessions. It's pouring. And Major League Baseball said, well, we're not letting anybody do that. You got to buy the beer here, except that the stadium doesn't have anywhere near the infrastructure for that. So everybody's sort of pissed off on that. They ended up, both teams had a day off supposedly yesterday, so they played yesterday at like maybe 12 o'clock or something, and somehow they got the field playable. And they played yesterday, and I don't know how many people came back, maybe a third of that or a quarter of that, but I'm sitting there going, what a fiasco, huh?
God, well, I hope they can land a team someday. Maybe the White Sox.
God. Well, they're not going to do. Sox aren't going to get the same. Hey, what about those White Sox? This kid Montgomery what is he? The new Roy Hobbs? Got like 7 home runs in the 2-3 weeks he's been playing.
Yeah, I saw them win last Monday night.
Well, they were up 4-0 last night and then lost 5. But they're kind of fun to watch now, and they actually believe when they go to the park they're going to win, which is a big change.
I think the attendance was pretty dismal though.
Well, I mean, how much of that, John, is habit? I mean, I was a Ute, you know, we're not going to go into how long ago that was. If you decide you wanted to go to the game, you went to the game, right? You went,
yeah.
you went there and you grandstand or boxes, whatever you could get, and you went. I don't think it's, what do you think the walk-up crowd is in these places? 1% now? If you don't have tickets, if you don't buy your tickets in January, you don't go. Jimmy, you share season tickets. If you didn't have them, how many nights would you be, at the end of the day, would you say, hey, Chief, let's hop the L and just see if we get into the game? I can't imagine us doing that. Can you?
No, I can't.
No.
If that was the way you used to go to a game, right? Yeah. You went and you bought your ticket and then you went.
I don't know about the middle of the game or the end of the game, but, yeah, it was usually a spur-of-the-moment decision. Like, hey, the Cubs are at 120. It's 1 o'clock. Let's hop the L. Let's go. Very simple.
Yeah, well, it's... I mean, if you don't sell tickets in January and February, I don't think you have a crowd. And the Sox have been totally losing that crowd. Now, the question is, next year, are people going to take a chance on the 10-game package or the 15? They got some people to watch here. This kid Montgomery, I saw the first game I saw him. I go, God, this kid looks pretty good. Where'd he get him? He's the number one draft pick from Indiana someplace. And he's been hacking around the minors for 3 years out of high school, and all of a sudden, no, here he is. But... God, the kid's like, what, 6'4", 220, strong as an ax, hit the ball a mile. And he's a pretty good shortstop. I mean, I'm looking at it. We got that guy and we got PCA. I can't even remember two young players the same time of that level coming up in our city. You know, maybe, well, I guess we could say, you know, Billy Williams and Ron Santo, but how long ago was that? But the reason why I ask you, Jen, is that if you look at this stuff, We've been trying to educate people on the difference between the household survey and the other survey. If you look at the household survey and the huge bump up in January, so let's kind of forget that. We've had what? We had 2-month revisions that everybody's bitching about, right? Well, the March people employed is 163,508. In July, the number is 163,106. So it's 400,000 down. Okay, and if you look at if you added the establishment survey together in those 4 months, it's got to be what? 600,000 up. And so why when one has a revision toward the other one, or they're still up, they're not down. Why would you not sort of expect that? I mean, And one of it is one person's reporting is the establishments, and one is the actual people working. And one is counting if you have two jobs, one doesn't. And when they start to mismatch like that, why don't you think one of them is going to have a revision? It's not crooked. It's just they're only as good as what they get from these companies, right? I don't know. I mean, what do you want people to do? Do you want to invest the money into every day people tell you how many people show up for work? Or do you want it weekly now, or do you want it?
Well, wouldn't it be more sensible to include in the household survey a question, how many jobs are you working?
Well, I mean, are you employed? The answer is yes. That's the way they do it.
Well, but that doesn't seem like best way to ask the question. So.
Well, I mean, what if you're like our buddy Andrew?
Are you working multiple jobs would be one starting point, I think. You really want to know that, and I think we do.
Well, then you get... You're the census guy. That thing they sent out... How many people do they send out that big form to every year? I got it once.
It's a very, very small percentage of the population.
Yeah, now that's where... In there, they ask you everything. They ask you every time you were in the bathroom, for God's sake, if you fill the thing out. But they're on you if you don't fill it out. Now, that thing asks all that stuff, right? How often do you put that in? Every 10 years?
That is far more intrusive than anything at the decennial census, so as it should be.
What kind of response did they get on that?
On the
real intense one
that goes in depth.
Yeah,
I think they get pretty good response.
Well, they keep dunning you if you don't send it.
Well,
in.
Yeah, yeah.
Do they ever send?
They
ever
annoy you enough where you want to get it out of your, off of your inbox? So,
do they ever send anybody to your house to demand it?
I don't know. I've never received one, Tom.
I got one about 4 years ago, and I'm going through it. I think the thing had to be 60 pages long, yeah? Or maybe 35, 40, but it was, how many people in the house, what is their education, but it was nothing like, by the way, is anybody working? It was nothing like the regular census, that type of thing. It was real intrusive, where are you working, who's your employer, how much you make. I mean, it was about as intrusive as it gets. So here, you want to hear my tire story, a little lighter?
Yeah.
So, I decide, I push the tires on my fine truck about as far as I can make it. So one of them has got a little slow leak in there. So, of course, I have the compressor, and it's down some. And I go, if I run that big tire up on this compressor, all I'm going to do is burn the compressor out. So I head up to the gas station to get some air. How much do you think air was?
Over $2.
$2.50.
Yeah, okay.
All right, so...
Market rate.
Yeah, so I fill the thing up, and I know the tires I want, these Firestone Destinations. They're about as highway friendly as you can get while they still have the snowflake, winter tire type of rating. Because I got out of the alley in the snow and the first one out, so I gotta have something like that. But I also don't want to be going down the highway where the guy next to you is mad, it's so loud. So. I read up on these things for like a year, so finally I get them. Well, the tires in the back of the truck are 18 years old, so they got to go. The ones in the front don't look so hot, but they're 7 years old. I said, let's do all four. And I called, and I knew what the prices of the tires were, so I called Firestone because they're open on Sunday morning. And I didn't have to worry about missing some work or anything like that. So I called the guy, and I said, these things are like $210 everywhere. And the guy goes, well, we can't match the $210. But we'll make it up to you. We won't charge you to put them on or balance them or anything like that. And I go, fine. So it ends up being the same price. And so I trundle in there at 8 o'clock in the morning. And I notice that I'm the only one in the place that is older, might know something about cars. Everybody else is like real young and a lot of minorities. And not that that, but you can just sort of tell, now these guys are giving me this right price. They're going to check the alignment. And I go, somewhere here there's going to be a, there's going to be a hitch in there. Why I gotten so suspicious, John? I have no idea. So sure enough, the guy says to me, we can't align it because you got a little play in your pitman arm and your idler arm, which I, of course, know what those are. I don't know how many people do. I said, how much? Oh, a little bit. I mean, is this something we got to do today? Because it's real bad. You can feel it in the steering. And he goes, no, you don't have to do it today, but, sooner rather than later. And I said, I don't really feel it in the steering. By the way, how much you want for that? Guess what the guy says.
$500?
$1,100. I go
11 pounds.
I said, wait a minute. We're talking about an idler arm and a pitman arm. I know exactly what those are. I know how much they cost. They're probably $80 a piece. Where are you getting the 1100? The guy looks at me like he immediately realizes that I kind of know what I'm talking about and like drops the subject. And I'm going, what the bleep? Is this what we're doing to people now? I mean, as soon as this COVID thing happened, you and I should have, and tariffs on top of it, we should have bought a car repair facility. God, you can just rip the hell out of people, and they don't have no idea. And then when they got nowhere else to go, it's really
something. And hire your most untrustworthy person to do the pricing.
Yeah. Well, untrustworthy to them, but trustworthy to you.
Yeah, trustworthy.
So what is, and just as this, I feel like friggin', who was the guy? I'm starting to meet like Andy Rooney. I'm heading out on the Stevenson. Of course, it's packed. And you know, Lollapalooza's on and all kinds of other stuff. And I don't know what, we don't have any police anywhere. The amount of shoulder riding on the Stevenson now is getting ridiculous to the point where, plus the motorcycles go between cars, which always is enough to frighten you, right? Because they just miss your mirror. So all of a sudden, I see this guy flying down the shoulder. And two of the motorcycle guys pull out on the shoulder ahead of him. So the guy has to, you know, slow down a little bit. The look on his face, John, how outraged he was. This is my shoulder. What are you two idiots doing on my shoulder? the guy was entitled to not only to be on the shoulder, but a free ride. Nobody else got to do the same thing. It was just him. I'm like, what are we doing here?
There must be a different driver's ed program now than when I took it in 1969.
Well,
defensive driving. Defensive driving.
But as a man about the world, as a Renaissance man and an educated guy, what is it about differences in people? You know, and you can sure see them in Washington or any place or in the state. Just their views on entitlement or something. I mean, ever since I've been driving, if ever you're driving along and all of a sudden, which you don't see this anymore, if you see a policeman with somebody pulled over, obviously for like speeding or something, like I said, is like a distant memory. There's two kinds of people in the world. One group, and I'm in that group, would say, well, it looks to me like the police are out today. Not that I'm a speeder anyway. I'll make sure that I pay attention here going forward. There's another group that says, he's got that guy, he can't get me, and hits and it's pedal to the metal. Where does that difference in mentality show up? 8th grade? 7th grade? 5 years old? 50 years old? They're just
pretty early, I think, you know, and it's modeling, Tom. You know, if you're a 5-year-old, you see that being done. I remember being aware at 5 or 6 how people drove. I remember who I felt more comfortable in a car with in the back seat, looking over somebody's shoulder, than other people. I could sort of understand the difference in driving habits and people who were, you know, pushing the envelope or, you know, going, you know, 5 miles over the speed limit or anything, you know, to get by in the moment, and other people who would never do that. And, you know, of course, nowadays, you know, everybody does U-turns, and, you know, I never do a U-turn. I know why they're prohibited, for one thing.
Yeah.
But everybody does them constantly. It doesn't matter what the traffic flow is or anything else. And I really just feel that people are probably feel very safe, given the way cars are built today and the safety features in cars. They've got a very misleading sense of their own, you know, imperviousness to what's going on around them. And of course, cars are flimsier than they used to be, and I don't think they, you know, withstand accidents as well as they used to.
Well, the cars don't, but the occupants are way better off. When we were,
oh yeah, there's. If they're obeying the law, they're wearing seatbelts, which not everybody does to this day. But even so, people are misled into thinking that, you know, can't happen to me. Right? It's more important I do this U-ey now than that I go to the corner and make a left turn and come back out. You know, all the other things that I would do and the people traditionally did because it just made sense to do that. It wasn't worth taking that risk. And now people feel like there's greatly reduced risk of doing that. So there's a lot of factors.
It gets into the vernacular to where my brother just said, my nephew's wife, she's adorable. She teaches math, and there's two little girls that one, they're just funny as hell, and they're good little kids. And she says to me, well, you know, I was talking about the motorcycles, and now, you know, all of a sudden some guy will fly between cars or something. And she says, well, She says to me, they have a different set of rules, don't they? And I go, no, they don't. She goes, really? They seem to think they do. Yeah, they can't go between cars. They're supposed, they're a vehicle like anything else. They're, if two cars are lined up, they don't get to go through the middle. that's not a rule for motorcyclists. I mean, it's at a point where I was watching on the 10 o'clock news last night. They're having this thing on Michigan Avenue where they're putting this golden bike memorial up for this guy to get whacked by a car and died. Now, that seemed like a nice enough kid. I mean, I last thing I want is a guy dead, right? A traffic accident. But I have not seen in 5 years a bike stop for a stop sign or red light. I mean, I don't want to see anybody get whacked, but why is everybody shocked when somebody gets whacked? I mean, all they got to do is open their eyes. Every intersection is a danger zone. They go flying right through it.
Yep. I mean, this is after, you know, we've had a complete, you know, reconfiguration of driving paths to include, you know, bike lanes, and yeah, sometimes the least obvious place where you think there would be a bike lane, and to give them all, you know, the privileges of an exclusive space, and they can still just, you know, violate stop signs and stoplights with impunity. I mean, why bother?
Well, I was listening to, again, how people's expansion of, I wish I still had it, Jen, and I'm not accusing you or our gang, because you guys put a lot more thought behind it, but it was an article about why people get so far on the right or the left, and why they just, you know, toe the party line, whichever party there is. And it had to do with people's daily lives and how our vote is, you come right down to it, everybody should vote, but everybody also knows your particular vote, unless it's, you know, Virginia City and it's 25-25 and Ben Cartwright's trying to decide between Haas and Little Joe for mayor. I mean, you know, that doesn't happen. You'll see the coin going up and down in the booth. I mean, that doesn't happen. I mean, basically everybody knows that, you know, your vote is like basically peeing in Lake Michigan, right? I mean, you want everybody to vote. You want the show up. You want the support for the system. But by and large, you know, one vote's nothing, right? And this is, well, so people get that, so they're not like me, that this is essentially my job, is to watch this stuff for other people and manage their money. Plus I do the show. So I'm going to give an awful lot more time to this. And you guys, just because you're interested in the world and always have been, maybe it's a holdover from the Vietnam era where we watch the news every night because we might get shot if we didn't, right? But we're more into this than most people. Basically, they said what people end up doing is they sort of form an affiliation with one side or the other, and they let that side do their thinking for them, to the point where you look at the issue and you go, if I'm on the right, where does the right feel about that? Or if I'm on the left, where does the left feel about that? Instead of, you know, when you see people that, I mean, I understand what's happening, and I don't want to call anybody, you know, an idiot, but to me, anybody who looks at an issue, the first thing they think of is, what does my side think about it, instead of thinking yourself what you think about it. I think that's not exactly the triumph of the education system that you and I know. I mean, it should be your opinion, and if you want to check the facts, you should check them, not just read one side or the other. And anyway, so I'm driving around and they're listening. I don't know what it was, 60 minutes of what I'm interviewing one of these Trump, I don't know, I'll call them lapdogs, and he's talking about the tariffs and stuff. Well, the one lady who's answering says, well, you know, I don't understand how there's a tariff increase because Canada has said they might want to pile on to the European countries of saying they're going to recognize a West Bank place, country, for lack of a better term. And how he's tying that together to a tariff, she goes, I don't get the connection at all. And the guy goes, hey, look, they've got this emergency, what's the name of the bill, the Emergency Something-Something Act, where the Congress has given the president tariff authority under emergency situations to act before going to Congress, even though in the Constitution, tariffs are definitely, imposition of tariffs is something charged to the Congress. Well, the Congress turned around and said, what is it, John? What's the name of the bill? The Emergency Something-Something Act?
I can't call it right now.
Jimmy, you know. What is that thing? It's Jimmy will find out. The guy says, this act basically says, it gives the president the right, especially this great president, whatever, gives the president the right to define anything he wants as an emergency. And I'm sitting there going, I don't think it said that, and I don't think anybody meant that. Do you? You get to define a murder of an American on a bus in Venezuela, and that's an emergency, and you get to put a tariff. I don't think that's what anybody meant. Do you? That any you get to define. It started with Bush 1, and you know Clinton probably did it too. We're having a war on terror. Well, what does that mean? There's always going to be one terrorist left. Does the war ever end? No, the war never ends. There's always a war now. I can do whatever I want. That's a reach for me, Jan. And I think it's probably a reach for even... I think it's a reach for you, I would guess.
Well, I hear what you're saying, but coming to the subject of groupthink, you know, higher ed and the education system overall has been captured by groupthink. And it's one side, Tom. I think you'd have to admit it too.
Admit that at all. I haven't been in these colleges.
There's no room for political independence in a postgraduate course in, say, the humanities, or I would suspect in a lot of other fields. And it's the same thing in high school. I mean, this is what COVID finally exposed to people who didn't really know what their kids were studying, and they were around the house enough to know during a Zoom class the kind of books that were being used and the kind of ideas that were being discussed and the kind of opinions that were not tolerated. So I think groupthink was pretty much in one direction and still is in higher ed and education down the ranks. So
Jen, you might be one of God knows what percentage of people, small percentage of people, since you came up in the educational area, and you know, I try and quiz any teacher that I'm near to find out. But how many people either believe that because Trump or his cronies told them, or don't believe it because they don't believe anything Trump said? How many people actually, the COVID people that you're talking about, because I knew Audrey's cousin before he passed, we used to have dinner with his neighbors, and they had a kid in grammar school, middle school, and high school at the same time. And they were looking at some of the lessons like you're talking about, and they were sort of horrified at what they were seeing. Okay, now because they actually were looking at it on a day-to-day basis, I believe them, even though I didn't really believe them politically that much. But they're telling me the story. I can't believe this is what they're learning, even in math or other things. And all of a sudden, I'm sitting there, these are people that actually are looking at the stuff. They're telling me this. I don't think they're lying to me. And even though I'm supposed to be this left-winger, which I'm not, I'm believing every word they said because they actually... We're reading me the stuff off from that day. But how many people who have an incredible opinion on this, of what they're teaching in school, have no idea? They've never looked at any of it, right or left. They just believe one side or the other.
A lack of curiosity on the part of a lot of parents. I'm just speaking for myself, Tom, with my relationship with the colleagues I have at my institution, people that I taught alongside. A long period of time, attended meetings, thought I was on the same page with them, and I never had any real qualms with anything politically, tainted, and certainly not when it came to what we did in the classroom. And that all changed completely.
When did it change? We're going to break, Jim. I don't remember any of that. I mean, I really don't. I mean, I know that Father Fitzgerald was...
I experienced it as a grad student.
Where?
And I at Loyola. And I knew politically where I should keep my mouth shut for the rest of the semester on this topic, because I knew my opinion would not only not harmonize with anybody else, but I would be attacked.
Was this when you were left or when you became right of Attila the Hun?
This is when I thought I was open-minded.
Oh.
And I all of a sudden, saw what happened to somebody.
I never saw anything. The only thing in the University of Chicago was they were dead set against the monetary policies of some of the Keynesian guys or something, but that was a economic thing. It had nothing to do with politics. If anything, those guys are pretty conservative.
I can't speak for the economics field. I can certainly speak for the humanities field.
Really?
Yeah. And Tom, it became so toxic that this was not my decision or anything I thought I had done, but I pretty much severed ties with all of my former colleagues after I was attacked in a series of dinner parties that were perfectly congenial events.
What were you guys fighting about?
The beginning. Well, they were fighting when they found out I wasn't going to vote for Hillary Clinton. And I didn't mean it as any kind of, you know, this was not an opener to get up on a soapbox and start yelling and screaming.
The rest
of the dinner party turned into let's beat up on the Trumper here.
I wouldn't vote for Hillary if she was running against Jimmy.
Well, I'm just saying, I mean, I had lots of reasons not to vote for her, but I thought they would be respected, whatever they were, in the social group, and clearly wasn't a tolerated opinion.
She was a terrible candidate.
Well, you can take that up with my colleagues. You have to take it up with me.
Well, you might have liked her better than Trump, but didn't make her good.
I'm just saying, you know, the group think that we were just talking about has become tyrannical in higher ed.
Oh,
in supposedly liberal organizations that expected students' opinions to be respected when they didn't go with the flow for whatever the class seemed to believe as a group. You always wanted to hear dissenting views because they were productive to teaching.
How do you learn let somebody
explain themselves, no matter how idiotic or off the wall that the opinion seemed to be. Give the person a chance before you...
I guess maybe going to a school that was run by Ted Hesburgh was the unusual situation, huh? You could argue with that guy all you wanted. All you had to do was make sure your arguments were perfect. Be willing to write them down.
Classes.
Yeah. SP Futures up 40, NASDAQ Futures up 197. Go to a quick break, John. We'll be back. Be right back. Stocks and Jacks.
Interested in promoting your business to a high-end audience comprised of entrepreneurs, traders, executives, and the everyday business person? Consider advertising on Stocks and Jocks. With a devout listenership covering the Chicago market, along with a vast online presence, advertising on Stocks and Jocks may be just what it takes to put your business over the top. For more information, contact me, Matt Weber, at matt@stocksandjocks.net. That's matt@stocksandjocks.net.
Stocks, Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
You are out of control.
Here, right now. Right here. Right now. Right now.
Go, Tom.
Blowing up back Stocks and Jacks. Somehow Jimmy on the board. I don't... Jan, just a last comment on that. We'll change to something else, but you and Kevin are very conservative, and I disagree with you on a lot of your points, but I've learned from you guys. How do I learn anything from anybody that thinks the same way I do? What's the point? It's like an echo chamber.
Well, that's the liberal approach to education, Tom.
I don't get that. I don't get that at all.
There's got to be room for more than your own.
I don't. If you can't... If you can't defend your opinion against the other side and learn from the other side, what good are you, for God's sake?
My concluding comments are, and this is borne up by what my nieces have told me too, who have gone through, you know, it's the same, higher ed institutions, you know, you and I and my brother and lots of people I know did, and at a high school environment that was on paper far more liberal than the one I.
Yeah, Marist never did any of that either. Anyway, SP Futures up 39, NASDAQ Futures up 192. After break, Jan, get ready for this. I'm going to ask you, is this the buy the dip thing of the century, or is this going to be a broken dream here? That's the question today. Dow Futures up 218 over in Europe. DAX up 327, 1.4%. Now, again, everybody's down heavy Friday. FTSE up 40.4%. That's not as much. The CAC sort of in the middle, up 66.9%. Over in Asia, this guy started down last night. Nikkei was down 508. That's 1.25%. Hang Seng up 225.9%. Shanghai up 23.6. I think everybody likes the idea that the OPEC output height is maybe trumping the news here. Because, I mean, I don't know what 400,000 barrels is going to do, but we'll see. Bonds down 2 basis points, 4.20. Bund down 3 basis points, 2.64. We've got oil. Now it's down $1.35. It was only down something 65 cents earlier, so it's down... $65.98, which is at a pretty low end of the range here. The tippy top high is 77. It's been 66 to 69.70 for quite a while. Now it's stuck a little bit below that. Gold up $20, $34.19, back over 34. Silver up 36 cents. That's a big move. $37.29. Copper unchanged, $4.43. We talked about that earlier. U.S. dollar pretty much steady in here at 115.8. Got to be as high over 117 against the euro, and then it was down lower 15, so it's kind of in the middle here. British pound 133, nowhere near the 135 it got to, and we've got crypto down $61, not doing anything this morning, at 114.398.3, but a ways from the 118 it was last week. So it took a big hit on Friday as well, and not coming back. Jimmy Redforce, Traffic, Weather, Sports. Cubs win.
Cubs did win in the bottom of the ninth. The solo home run, it is 7:35 here in Chicago. High Right now it's 70 degrees, high of 79. We are going to be hazy sun, unhealthy air quality. Thank you, Canada, due to the wildfires. Low tonight is 70. In Phoenix, it's 85, high of 113. Again, danger of dehydration or heat stroke if outside for long periods of time. The low tonight will be 86. On traffic, the inbound Edens from the Montrose, from Montrose is 20 minutes. Inbound, that's inbound Kennedy. Inbound Edens from Lake Cook, 34. Inbound from the Eisenhower to Wolf is 25. Inbound Dan Ryan from 95th, 14. And the inbound Stevenson from 294 to the Ryan is 24. In regards to what you were talking about, that is the International Emergency Economics Power Act.
Yes.
IEEP, which gives the president the right to regulate commerce in response to unusual or extraordinary threats inside the from outside the country, including those deemed of terrorism. So that's a broad stroke. So I guess if you deemed you're at war with everybody, you could go ahead and do tariffs.
Evidently. It's everything's an interpretation, right, Jen?
Yeah, well, that's just what executives do.
I guess. I really do think that some of these solutions. I was listening to some of the people in my family are fairly liberal, and I was talking about Pritzker's stuff yesterday, and he done two things in the last few months. That Jen, at some point, don't we have to have somebody who can follow something through on the logistics of anything? A few months ago, and I was ragging about a thing that came through. And I don't want people to have to eat what they don't want to eat. I want everybody to live happy. Let's all just get along. He came out with a thing where, well, not him, but he signed a bill that says that anybody going to high school gets to have, such if they have on a restricted menu, meaning if you're halal or you're on a kosher diet, if you're Orthodox Jewish, so forth. I mean, that somehow the high schools have to, and maybe the grammar schools, have to provide that sort of stuff. And I immediately, I'm not thinking of Kevin, but what Kevin does a lot of, I'm thinking of the logistics of that. I'm going, wait a minute. How the hell do you do that? That's when you tell the parents to pack a kosher halal sandwich and bring it to school, right? That's what you do. There's no, what if you have one kid who wants a kosher lunch at 50 high schools? How the hell do you do that? First of all, it's not a kosher kitchen. Those know anything about Jewish religion, I know a little bit. You can't just get a piece of kosher steak and wing it in your frying pan. If the frying pan has ever had anything in there that's not kosher, you can't use it. And if I ever had some of my conservative clients over to my house, I'd have to get a new frying pan. I'd have to have paper plates and make sure nothing touches anything. I know enough about that because I dated a Jewish girl for 15 years. And I don't know about halal. It's probably somewhat the same. Now, the logistics of it are, I'm going to say, impossible, even though I think it's probably not a bad idea. It'll be great if it could happen. Now, yesterday, he signs in a thing about how insurance companies need to be forced to pay for, what's the term, John? Equine something? Where riding horses is very beneficial to a real lot of people. I mean, I get that part. I mean, my significant other, Audrey's always loved horses, and one of her big disappointments right now is she doesn't own a horse. And she loves it, absolutely loves it. Her idea of a great afternoon is going to clean out the stall and messing around with your horse. And I'm going, ugh. But, I always helped her. I mean, for horses to me, I want to bet on them, John. That's about it. I helped her out all the time. I mean, she liked something she liked, and that's fine. I mean, and it was very relaxing for her, and I get it. So they're talking about how a lot of kids with autism and so forth, animals are a great thing, and I get that. And if there's some way we could do something like that, I mean, but I'm sitting there going, when I first met Audrey a long time ago, she was in the horse. There had to be, I'm going to say, 10 to 15 stables southwest of the city. Maybe 20, Jen? I'm going to say we're down to 8, possibly. You drive through the Forest Reserve. You used to see, you saw people on horseback all the time. There's nothing but trails. There's hundreds of miles of trails in the Forest Reserve. The best place to have a horse, other than maybe out west than anywhere in the world. I never see a horse now, John. I mean, rarely. And there's probably down to five stables. I'm sitting there going, okay, let's say we've got 10,000 kids that could benefit from this. How in the bleep, what are the logistics? We have to somehow find 50 stables. We've got to find 500 horses that are all trained for kids. We're going to have how many people? How do you even go about doing something like that, even if you know it's a good idea? I mean, can you cut back to ponies in a petting zoo or things like that? Whatever you can do, I'm all for people. If you can get somebody with autism to feel better in life, Jan, you know me well enough to know I'm all for it, but I'm just sitting there. I don't even have to get out a piece of paper. How the hell could this ever work? I mean,
who cares, Tom, how it works? Somebody sponsored legislation, and you know the paper trail as to who that sponsor is, you know, probably leads to, you know, the stable industry, or, you know,
there aren't any. They were all owned by Mon Paz. Well, at least the ones I knew.
No, not anymore, probably.
Maybe not.
It's like agribusiness, you know. Is the strength in numbers, and there's no percentage in trying to run a small operation when you've got exposure, insurance risks, and everything else for having a stable or letting the public use the horses or whatever. So somebody's got, you know, a reason to think this is an explosion for business, which, of course, it should be. I mean, this is the idea, is to pump money into it. We don't know where the money will come from, nor does anybody care. But there'll be some kids maybe who will get a big kick out of riding a horse for once in their lives, but the public is going to be dinged for several generations to make that happen. So,
well, I actually one of the gentlemen who used to go nameless used to help us out with the show and may again hopefully in the future, because now he's working back downtown, has a son who's way, what do they call it, the spectrum, nonverbal, you know, real bad autism, and he lives in Glen Ellyn. And Glen Ellyn is, like he said, he could never move. Glen Ellyn is spectacular for people that have kids with special needs. There's schools, they come and get the kids. And every summer, I think, I don't know if it's a week or two, to give the parents a break and a time to go on vacation, they'll actually bring the kids into whatever you want to call it, a camp, not near a river, hopefully. And some of the years, they really do involve animals, ponies and dogs and whatever. And the kids absolutely love them. They really identify, even though, you know, they've been dealt a bad blow in life, they really identify with the animals. So I kind of know where this is coming from. I just don't know how you get from there to 5,000 horses people can go ride. I mean, it just seems like a long stretch to me.
It's part of the bigger story, Tom, of why there's almost no interest, it seems, in pursuing, you know, investigations into the reasons for the explosion in autism rates. But there's, you know, always interest in throwing money at managing the symptoms associated with autism. I mean, there are cases of autism actually being reversed in people with, you know, intense detoxification programs to remove mercury and all these other substances that seem to be at least contributing to their conditions, but there's no emphasis in doing that because it would indict the pharmaceutical companies and lots of other people who look the other way, and instead let's just manage the symptoms and get horses for everybody. You know, this is ridiculous, but it's the way things are done today when you can't go after the real culprit. So.
Well, I remember my stepfather was in the veterans home in Manteno, and I can never say enough good things about that place. I mean, people say the system, the state can't do anything. Bull. He was in three or four nursing homes before that. They were all hellholes compared. This place is terrific, and the people there were spectacular. And he was in a group where, you know more about this than me, maybe, but not because you got it. But there was the Alzheimer group, but he wasn't in there. The Alzheimer's, you know, they got to be constantly watched and so forth. He was in a group that had real circulatory problems, but it wasn't Alzheimer's. You know, they just were, I don't know, whatever you want to call it, but... So I'd go there on a Saturday morning, and they'd have a movie on, usually a Western movie that I liked. I'm sitting there, and he's there, and maybe 10 other people. And no conversation at all. I mean, once in a while somebody will say something, or somebody will spin his chair around in a circle. I mean, you know, really sad. And well, one day Audrey comes with, and she brings her little pooch. At the time she had, that was her name, Rosie. She had this little Japanese chin, you know, a little bit of a thing. They think that they absolutely rule the world. And she would not, she wouldn't back down from anybody. She went from person to person, hopped up in the wheelchair. You never saw a room light up with her there with those guys. All of a sudden, they came out of whatever they were doing, or petting her, big smile. I mean, animals are real serious, seriously can help people that are in a bad way. They, every you know, most people, and she did more in 1 hour in that place than I don't know what kind of drugs you could have put in there. So I'm not certainly above or opposed to, and a lot of people do animal therapy in hospitals. I mean, little kids getting surgery, all of a sudden you bring in a dog for them to pet for an hour. It's perfect. I mean, most people do it because they do it, what do you call it? They do it a couple times a week just to do it. I mean, they like doing it, right? And they think it's very rewarding for them and the people. So it's not like some this stuff doesn't work. I just, you know, I sort of just don't want, you know, the logistics is always a problem, right?
Oh, I agree completely, Tom, and I'm all for therapy animals, and I know, you know, their importance, especially, you know, the people who are in a demoralizing situation where they've, you know, got a bad, you know, outcome facing them, or they, you know, they're an uncertain outcome, and their kids, and then the response is always, you know, extremely moving to watch. I'm all for that. You know, I'm not trying to bash the idea of therapy animals or introducing them to, you know, to people who need a, you know, a pickup to their spirits. But when you start talking about, you know, adding to the equine community and the thinking about the horses for starters.
Oh yeah.
To do it right, I mean, it takes a tremendous amount of land to exercise a horse, and a lot of, you know, top flight people who are sensitive to what an animal's needs are, and, you know, the value of a horse just in terms of dollars and cents, but also, you know, the risk associated with injuries and all this stuff. It's the most, for some reason, you know, and leave it to the whoever sponsored the legislation, you find the most expensive and the most, you know, land intensive use.
Oh yeah, yeah.
For an animal, and we're going to expand that. And to me, it's just like, wouldn't it be better to look into the causes of autism?
Oh yeah,
I just spend some of that money doing that. I think you'd have better results. I'm thinking about the horse.
Is it true you tried to grab one of those rats out of the alley and make him your therapy animal? Didn't some guy?
I haven't fallen that far yet, Tom.
Jimmy, weren't we riding home last week and somebody tried to say he had a therapy snake or something?
Yes.
What the hell was that all about? Some guy claims he had a therapy snake, John.
Well, I think Chief...
Somebody's, you know, therapy animal is somebody else's vermin.
Well, to get it on the ridiculous side, you know, I understand John is a professor, but I had my neighbor, daughter just got out of Champaign, and she had a cat in the dorm, and she went online and found a doctor to give her a certification that the cat is a therapy animal. Now, when I was going to school, you couldn't have any animals in the dorms.
That was so long ago, Jimmy. You don't get it. You got to have therapy stuff now.
I guess, but on another note on sports, President Trump did win the senior golf event at Bedminster for the third year running.
I am so happy with modern medicine, how he could do that with that horrible case of bone spurs he has had as a child.
Well, as you know, he is a horrible cheat. But again, he won the seniors tournament at his course. Surprise, surprise.
Oh, God. Well, how many times, how many goals did Putin score in his last, the hockey game when he was still playing? Or the goal he ran the other way?
The last time he played, it was like 3-4 years ago, and he had Alex Ovechkin. He scored like 7 goals.
Yeah. God. Well,
do you remember the dog we had briefly at Morrissey Hall in college?
No, I don't. I know the two guys that had the rats and the cleaning lady killed.
Yeah, well, I had the guy down the hall from me had an iguana. The maid freaked out one day when she went in and the iguana was loose in the room. She was trying to make the bed. Bill Spicuzza had to get rid of the iguana after that. But down the hall, Dean Canavo and Dick Marquette had a dog that they rescued somewhere in South Bend, and it lived in the dorm until, you know, they discovered, and they had to eventually moved off campus and took the dog with them. But it was named Marcus Welby D.O.G., which I always thought was very clever.
Well, how many people remember that show on TV? Yeah. So Jan, what's going to be the crazy stuff? This, what do you? Well, let's zero in on one. What do you make of this Palestinian state thing? I mean, I listened to a couple people yesterday, and I don't know the history of this all that much, but the dude was saying in 1948 there were two promises: Israel was going to get a state, and Palestine was going to. I was that part of the original declaration that there were going to be two states? I don't remember that, or I've never read it, of course.
Well, I don't think that the Zionist faction ever signed on to that, but that was pushed as this would be, you know, this would be the trade-off, that you'd get a state and displaced people would also have a state too. It was never, you know, it never bound anybody is the thing, and it was probably discussed in talking points leading up to the establishment of the state of Israel, but I don't know that there's any diplomatic, you know, settling of that issue such that this was promised, or where it would be, or who would have to, you know, move in order for this to happen. So that was pushed to the side pretty much and never resolved. Of course, this is what we're dealing with 77 years later. So,
Chad, if you were to take the Jewish population of Israel in, say, 1950, what percentage would you say were Jewish people that, like, never left Israel, and versus those that were in Europe somehow survived the horrendous Holocaust and just said, I'm out of here, and moved back to Israel? Would you have any kind of guesses to...
I think the overwhelming percentage would be, you know, immigrants who came from, you know, elsewhere, but mainly Europe, Central Europe, and Germany and Poland. And
so you think it was more people that came back, the diaspora that returned, essentially.
Right. And I mean, it would be the people who were actually, I think, able to salvage some kind of wealth and had, you know, some sort of a family structure still intact, where they hadn't been wiped out during the war.
But a lot came here, right?
And a lot came here too. And the outcry at the time was, you know, Palestine needed immigrants, that they needed, you know, Jews to go there as a homeland in big numbers, and this was preached, you know, vehemently, to make this homeland idea come to fruition. This would be, you know, the magnet to draw back the Jews who had been dispersed, you know, over 1,000 years ago, with the destruction of the, you know, enclave in Jerusalem, and it had been a process of dispersion ever since. This was, you know, emotionally, it was an extremely powerful way of attracting people, you know, and your Jewishness, it requires you to do this, and many did do it, and the population of Jews from elsewhere, you know, skyrocketed. But as you said too, a lot came, you know, to the United States, to Canada, lots of other places. So it wasn't like it was a unanimous thing that this is where, you know, Jews need to go down to the last person at all.
Well, is anybody, I'm asking you, I know you have a huge, I'm testing you here, a huge history, and actually so does our friend Mr. Lawler on the board. What was life like in terms of the politics from, when did the Spanish Civil War start, like 1934, 35 somewhere?
35, 36.
So yeah. That entire, let's say 35 to 45 abortion of a decade in the world, was the Middle East, the Israel, Lebanon, well, whatever it wasn't even called Israel back then, but was that area, was that area fairly stable, or was that, were they all fighting too? I don't know. I've never even read that.
It was very unsettled during the war, and there was, there were terrorist attacks on, you know, shipping, and, you know, the promise of bringing people there as a refuge. Angered some, and others were pushing it, and there was.
But the Nazis never grabbed it. The French never grabbed it. It just, I mean, everybody wanted the oil that they could get from there, but nobody ever, you know, the war was in North Africa. It never really got close to.
Right, and that's right. You know, no territory changed hands or anything during the war that I know of. There was definite. You know,
well, who governed it? Was it the Ottoman Empire?
No, British.
It was the British mandate.
Okay. You
know? And this was, you know, this was, you know, the British became, you know, as they began to lose their empire in you know, pretty rapidly after the war, and this was part of what I think FDR and Churchill disagreed so vehemently about. Was, you know, FDR thought this would finally be the end of, you know, British dominance in the world, and Churchill wasn't going to, you know, go sign on to that. So there was an expectation, as you know, Africa and colonies all over the world started to, you know, be separated from Great Britain.
So, like, Lebanon was a British colony? I did not know that.
No, Lebanon was French.
Okay, they were French.
Yeah, Lebanon was French.
French, Syria and Lebanon were French. Palestine, which is now Israel, was under British control. That is correct.
Well, you need, one of these days I'm going to have to take a two-Saturday all-day course in the Middle East in the early 1900s, the first half of the century, because I mean, that would be fascinating, John. Well, Jimmy seems to know. Well, you've been over there, right, Jimmy? That's why you know all this.
Yes,
you went over there.
I was also taught from a professor in college who was Palestinian, and it was kind of interesting up through until the British took over, up through the Ottomans. The Ottomans pretty much left that area kind of alone. Yeah, you had little fights now and then, but Jerusalem was always considered a holy city, so they allowed Jews. They actually had a mandate that Jews and Christians could not be persecuted, believe it or not.
Well, there were periods. I mentioned that you weren't doing the show that I made, but one of the guys wrote into the Quora was talking about there's been a lot of decades where the Muslims, the Jews, and everybody all got along pretty well in that whole area.
Correct.
Yeah. Oh, but really since the Crusades, you know, in with variations from time to time, depending on the politics elsewhere, but generally, you know, the bipartisanship was tolerated, and they lived in peace more or less, which they weren't. It wasn't happening in Spain and other countries, so it was kind of a, you know, a beacon in a way. This is when it's under Ottoman rule too, so it wasn't an all, you know, all bad thing of the Ottoman Empire in that regard. So
no, it was let
live and let live, and kind of enforce a you know, reasonable enjoyment of the space, no matter who you were. So,
well, there is enough agriculture, and there's enough. I mean, that area can feed itself, where a lot of the areas over there can't, and different disparate areas can't. But I mean, basically, there is enough water in a few areas for people that have farming and stuff, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's really the whole key to all this stuff. But what's going to be the craziness this week? I mean, is the Friday market move a one off that, you know, at the end of the day, we're still going to get labor numbers and blah, 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 and it's not exactly the move people like to see, but at the end of the day, we're going to get numbers, and they're all going to be all over the place like they have been forever. But I think there is this slowdown. I'm sensing it in a lot of places. Do you guys agree with me or not? I mean,
it's something, you know, and maybe when Audrey or Nancy are on next, something I've been following the last couple of days, you know, the percentage of real estate sales among first-time home buyers is declining precipitously in some places.
It's horrible.
And that to me shows that there's a real, and I don't see how what's going to reverse it. Even if housing prices were to drop sharply, I don't think this is going to stimulate a lot of home purchases by people who aren't already in the market. But I think it's one sign too of how the system is reaching some kind of freeze up. Where the only people who are trafficking in homes are the ones who already have one. At some point, that supply is going to take its toll on the whole market. So.
Well, that's what, you know, I have Jan, next time around, we'll talk about this. There's a site I found, and I want to, you know, Carl and a few other people to opine on it as to how accurate it is, but it's one of the things we always talk about is, you know, in numbers that we don't believe, right? We always talk about the CPI and basically how screwed up it is, right? And I think that's more on purpose than the labor numbers. I think the labor numbers are just hard to control or hard to corral. But one of the things, anyway, it's called something 2013. But what it allows you to do, I think back to 2000, I'm not so sure about before, you can actually query it on any line item in the CPI. which I never, you know, obviously if you know, if you really paid attention to this stuff like maybe Carl does, he has, you know, a spreadsheet going back that far, but by and large, I can get the CPI numbers and I can talk about them and maybe we don't believe them or do believe them or something, but I can't really tell you what, you know, what's the, you know, the brown rice line, right? Well, actually, this thing does do that, and I was able to go back and find owner's equivalent rent, which is their view of home ownership, right? Which I think is pretty bleeped up. I think we all do to a certain extent. So according to them, the owner's equivalent rent, which is their way of saying it's not housing prices, it's not insurance prices, it's they're imputing what it would cost for you to rent your own home. Correct, John? Isn't that what they're doing?
Yeah. Well,
and you and I and everybody else on the show, we do agree on some stuff, say that this number is basically horse bleep. It has been for a while. But if you look at their number from 2000 to 2025, it's gone from $100 to $213, which is slightly double, correct? And yet, I would say that the... that your housing prices, and I'll get the exact number here from our guys over to Debt Clock. Housing prices are up, I'm going to say, three times, wouldn't you?
Oh, yeah.
It's not a little over two. And I was looking at the, now whatever I found on this one, though, whenever you find this stuff, right now the, let me get the Debt Clock, I'll get the exact number. Your homeowner's insurance, I'm going to say, is today in 2007 is around $2,700 a year. All right, so right here I got the median new home, and now is $407,000. And I'm going to think in 2000 it was $165,000. All right, so we're talking 2.6 times, right?
Yep.
Not 2.1. Or 2.05, and this, and I went back to 2007. Your homeowner's price insurance was 700. So let's say, let's be nice and say in 2000 it was 550, right? Well, that's up damn near five times, right?
Yep.
And I'm going to have to say that your utilities, even though they're kind of a separate spot, so let's kind of forget those. But your taxes, I did a thing in 2020 before COVID. You know, John, it's getting harder and harder to find. I could not find historical Illinois taxes. Either I'm getting bad at it or they're covering all this crap up. When I did it in 2000...
I'll go with the latter.
Yeah. In 2000 or 2020, I added up almost three times 2000. So let's say your taxes are up three and a half times because they got to be up... Most of the stuff I read has it up 40% in the last 6 years, or 5 years. So I'm going to say that's gone up four to five times since 2000, your taxes. So tell me how this owner's equivalent rent number is correct. It's just not. Now, I mean, Trump can blame whoever the hell he wants. Simple fact is, since 2000, we've had almost the exact same number of Democratic and Republican presidents, right? Years. I mean, if you go back, the last 32 years is 16 apiece. I know that for sure. So the idea that the deep state is only, whatever. But anyway... So we need these numbers, but this is interesting. It's time. I'll keep doing a little more research on this, John, and we might have to have you. We had a couple of people maybe sick this week. Might have to have your ass back. What do you think?
I'm ready and able.
All right, but maybe you'll even come out some night.
Hey,
sure thing. Well, you won't be hearing from Nancy for a while. Nancy had shoulder surgery that went well, but she's can't raise her arm for a month. Can't drive. Can't do anything.
Give her my best.
Oh, she's absolutely the best. Anyway, she and Otter were, you know, great guests. You know, I was calling somebody to the doctor this morning. So that group, if you're in trouble, they help, John. That's just the way they are. SP Futures up 35. NASDAQ Futures up 197. Jimmy, thank you. Thank you for the input, for God's sake. How many trips have you made over there? One or two?
Just one.
And you were there for a while, though, right?
2 weeks.
Really?
Yes.
John, I've never been there. Have you? Middle East?
No.
Have you been to the islands? Stony Island, Blue Island?
Oh, yeah.
You've been to those islands?
Many times.
Back tomorrow, Stocks and Jocks.